Seeing none, Linda, thank you very much. Is there anyone else in Anchorage that wishes to testify on HB 43 conspiracy? Okay, thank you. We will remain online and ask people here in Juneau to begin to testify. And the first person I'd like to call is Deputy Commissioner Swackhammer from the Department of Public Safety.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is C.E. Swackhammer, Deputy Commissioner of Public Safety. I made my comments brief because you have a lot of comments on this bill. Public safety is very much in support of House Bill 43. And just two comments that to give you an example of a case where this would be applicable would be in a narcotics case, as Mr. Brown pointed out, that we recently had a case in Dutch Harbor where there were many people involved in the distribution of drugs. And from the transporting to distribution to the sale, and even to the point of making up false IDs and driver's license. But because of a lack of conspiracy, we were limited to those people that we could actually make direct buys from, thereby letting a lot of the other players that actually literally conspired for the sale of narcotics to relatively go untouched. I guess the second comment I'd make is that in listening to Mr. Brown's testimony, I think you ought to carefully consider what he said, because in my opinion, he gave a lot of arguments for this bill. Many times over my 27 years, I've seen cases that you cannot get the information to the jury because you have multiple defendants that have severed trials. I think for once, looking at five or six defendants behind a table, for once you're going to get the jury, the information to the jury of exactly what occurred in its entirety. And the other part about this bill is it does parallel the federal legislation. So I'd just like to make those comments.
Commissioner, thank you very much. Are there any questions? Okay, yes, Representative Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Commissioner Swackhammer. In your examination of the bill, did you see any areas that we should tighten up before we send it out to committee?
Not that I can find.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jack. Okay, I would like to now ask John Salemi from the Public Defender's Office to join us. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Salemi. I'm the director of the Alaska Public Defender Agency. I was invited to attend, and I don't have any prepared remarks with respect to either of the bills. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I can give you a general view of the public defender position with respect to each of them if you'd like.
Sure.
Would you like me to start with the conspiracy bill, which seems to be getting most of the comments?
Please.
All right. As you know, the public defender has submitted a fiscal analysis and bill analysis with respect to this bill. And I guess I want to start by saying that, like you, like all the members of the committee, I'm a citizen of Alaska. Public safety is an important issue to me. I have a family, a spouse, a child. I'm not in any way calculating my remarks to frustrate law enforcement, because all of us believe in strong law enforcement, whether we're part of the prosecution, part of law enforcement, part of the defense. Representative Phillips talked about the other states that have conspiracy, and I'm reminded of a remark I often hear is up here in Alaska, which is, we don't give a damn how they do it outside. I think that some of the recent trends with respect to criminal enactments are more politics than public safety. And I think the bottom line is to decide, given our diminishing resources, that's a real concern, and most of us come down here to talk about our budgets and then get sort of crowded into talking about criminal justice legislation and things. But given the finite resource that we now must operate within, do we need to create new laws? Because creating new laws, which creates new crimes, will have a fiscal impact. We could argue about what that fiscal impact would be in terms of quantity. Will it cost the Public Defender Agency $400,000 a year, or $200,000, or $800,000? Hey, I'm the first to admit that I don't have a crystal ball, and I can't give you with any precision how much it will cost. But I can tell the members of the committee that if the conspiracy bill is an important law to the state of Alaska, that it will have a distinct impact on the Public Defender Agency operation. Deputy Commissioner Swackhammer said he'd like to see a four or five defendants at the same table in a criminal case, and I can understand where some people might think that one trial might be better than four separate trials. But let me tell you, based on my experience as a practicing lawyer for 15 years, you get three or four lawyers in a courtroom together and a prosecutor or two on the other side, and there's a synergistic effect that seems to occur, and I don't know whether they're trying to outdo each other or to show off for their clients or each other, but I don't think that you're going to decrease the amount of work for the court system, for law enforcement, for prosecution or defense. I did mention in our fiscal note that Dean Guinelli's shop had taken a little bit different position in past years about conspiracy legislation and felt that it would have a fiscal impact that it would cost money to do. And I got the impression, and I haven't reread all their past fiscal notes, that they didn't believe it was a priority item with respect to public safety. Now, I know that Mr. Guinelli is here and will perhaps revise that position. Maybe they've rethought it. I don't know how much priority should be given to a proposed bill when I think in their fiscal note they indicated that it says the crime of conspiracy will be added as another count in a case that would have been prosecuted anyway. I'm not sure that a bill which would have that effect on criminal prosecutions, which I would say is a minimal effect, should be given priority, especially if it's going to cost money. But I know for conspiracy cases, talking with lawyers who've done them in other jurisdictions and done them in the federal courts, I know it's an expensive process. First of all, we're talking about serious cases, serious felony cases, as the bill indicates. And so automatically the ante is upped. We need experienced felony trial lawyers to handle those kinds of cases. We know that in conspiracy cases, the cases themselves are bulky. And what I mean that there's lots of material to absorb, lots of police reports, taped conversations, all kinds of stuff which a defense lawyer not only has to absorb but then share with his or her client. We've come to find out that the litigation with multiple defendants is often very protracted and difficult. Lots of pretrial issues come up, suppression issues, as Linda Branchflower mentioned, Fourth Amendment issues. So there are oftentimes protracted pretrial hearings, lots of arguments about what evidence should and shouldn't come in. And then the trials themselves, I've mentioned, are also lengthy and can be very expensive. I remember about a year ago when there was discussion about this, law enforcement and prosecution. Talked about leveling the playing field, that the need for the conspiracy law was to level the playing field, as if the playing field now was tilted in favor of the defense. And this was then Representative Donnelly's committee. It was some special hearings. And I don't know whether that's still a rationale which is used, but I don't think that you need a conspiracy law in order to level the playing field. I think that the playing field right now, using sort of due process as the lines in which we make the playing field and set it, it is certainly well in place, and I think it's a fair playing field and a fair system at this point in time. The other rationale which was given, and I don't know whether the law is giving it this year, is that, although I heard reference to it, is that in the federal system, it's great to charge people with conspiracies because then you get to sort of sit back and watch which co-defendant is going to run to the U.S. Attorney's office to rat on his buddies, and that this way we can avoid trials because you've got people turning state's evidence. And although that does happen on occasion, I don't think that would be a justification in and of itself for having a conspiracy law. And I don't think that we're necessarily looking, as Mr. Udland said, to make it easier to deal with these guys. Certainly, we want to have effective law enforcement and prosecution, but laws which would be calculated to make it easier to deal with these guys have to only be seen in the context of due process considerations. We have rules of evidence. There are Sixth Amendment rights to be able to confront witnesses and the statements that they make. Those rules have been on the books for a long time, a constitutional in dimension, and they're there for a purpose. They are to keep the playing field level. And I think when we start playing with the rules in piecemeal fashion, that we do run the danger of making the system less than fair. The only other thing I'll say about Mr. Uglin's comments is he used the marijuana analogy, and he said that the effect of the marijuana law marijuana possession being recriminalized has had virtually no effect in terms of law enforcement. I never made, as a representative for the Public Defender Agency, the argument that prosecutions would be overburdened and that the prisons would be filled with people who were going to be now charged and convicted of marijuana possession. In fact, our argument was that we had understood that law enforcement was not going to give priority to prosecution of marijuana possession, and therefore, why enact a law, why make a new crime for activity which law enforcement wasn't going to take seriously and didn't have the resources to deal with anyway? It sends the wrong message to the community. You make a new crime and then you ignore it. But my point is that the marijuana analogy doesn't hold up. We didn't argue that that was going to have a distinct fiscal impact on the Public Defender Agency, certainly not to the extent that this conspiracy bill will. You left me a note here. I'm going to see if I can find it. Do you want me to respond to
it? Yeah, nobody knows what that note's about.
You gave me a note which said, the fiscal note we have does not include the explanation you said was attached. Was it page left out? Oh, I thought you were talking, are you talking about Law's fiscal note or my own? In my explanation with respect to what?
You said our analysis in the fiscal note indicates, and then you talked. There is no analysis.
Oh, well, what probably occurred is I'm sorry that we're sort of debating about this, but all of our fiscal notes and analysis are sent through the Department of Administration. I will play it and then to the commissioner. I don't know what happens to them after that. Maybe they don't agree with me all the time. I get the sense they don't. So perhaps the analysis was not attached to the fiscal note. I apologize for that. If I've been referring to something that confuses me. Those are my comments with respect to that bill, and I'm certainly entertaining any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? President Norman? And for the record, Representative Nordland and Davidson have joined us, and Davidson is now temporarily absent again, but the record will reflect what time they joined us.
Thanks. John, do you fear that under this bill that there could possibly be a situation where a group of people would be charged with conspiracy for an act that they really never intended to commit, that, say, was a joke, let's say, a police officer overheard a conversation and decided to pursue it? Or any other individual?
That's possible. I don't think, we have very professional people in law enforcement and prosecution. I think we're very fortunate in that regard. Certainly that could happen. I know Mr. Brown talked about the potential abuses of use of the conspiracy law. As a former prosecutor, I think, and someone who's actually practiced in federal court, I think he's more conversant with that issue than am I. I expect that it would be a very rare instance where there would be that kind of confusion about an individual's intent, but it, theoretically, it happens to them.
So, we're still on here.
Yes, we are.
Okay. If I can follow up, then, John. So then, your primary concern about the bill is one of its fiscal impact, and that it probably isn't necessary because we have other laws and those can adequately help prosecute these folks.
Well, even based on the Department of Law's position, it doesn't seem to be a priority for them. They say that they're going to charge. People engage in conduct which they say could amount to conspiracy, they're going to charge under other laws, and they're going to add as a count this conspiracy, they're going to throw that in. And they say that, for whatever reason, that would be useful. And also it's useful because I will paraphrase, but relaxes the rules of evidence and allows other evidence in. Deputy Commissioner Swackhammer talked about, wouldn't it be nice to have everything come in front of the jury, or all the things that which he, as a part of law enforcement, or public safety, thinks would be important. And that would be useful and helpful. We have philosophical disagreements about that, because sometimes things which might be, in the eyes of law enforcement, useful in terms of gaining a prosecution, would be unfairly prejudicial in a determination of the facts relating to guilt or innocence. Basically, sometimes a jury can hear something that will inflame their prejudice or preconceived notions about crime, or they'll get a piece of evidence which can't be tested because it's just a statement. It's a piece of paper read into the record, and the defense attorney can't cross-examine the statement. That happens in conspiracy cases. And so one of the things I'm saying is fiscal impact And it may actually erode individual rights in terms of getting a fair hearing on the issues of guilt or innocence. And I know in a time when public safety is a paramount concern for everybody, it's not popular to talk about due process or fundamental fairness rights for people who are accused of crimes, because there's an assumption that, you know, hey, if the person hadn't done something wrong, then he or she wouldn't have been arrested in the first place, wouldn't have been prosecuted, wouldn't have been processed by the grand jury. But I've been in this business long enough to know that that isn't the way it always works. So I want a fair hearing. When the people are at the table and there's a judge and a jury there, I want to make sure that the jury is making their decisions based on facts, and facts which won't lead them to make decisions based on emotion or prejudice. I mean, in every trial, I suppose we could, in every rape trial, we could say, and by the way, there's a rape committed every 3.6 minutes. And I think that would affect a jury's decision on guilt or innocence. But we don't allow that kind of testimony because it distracts from the real issues. Did this person commit a sexual assault?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Slemmy, I haven't had the opportunity to listen to your testimony in committee before, so my question is based on just my observation and listening to your comments today. Is it normally your personal approach to an argument for or against a bill that you base your argument on the fiscal impact and the financial impact rather than maybe on the substance of the bill?
It really depends on the bill, Representative Phillips. Sometimes, I mean, there's no question that I don't come to you with a blank slate. I'm a defense attorney. I chose that profession for specific reasons. I believe in the importance of the defense function. What I will tell you is I do not play with the numbers of public defender fiscal notes in order to achieve a result. So I have a philosophical bent with respect to most criminal justice legislation. That does not in any way affect the numbers that I put down. We're talking about a conspiracy bill, and I think it's an open question as to if it's passed into law, how it will be used by prosecution. I think it's an open question. You could say you just add it as a count, but it could turn out to be an entirely different animal once it becomes law. I'm telling you that in an agency where I do 17,000 cases a year, statewide, with only 54 lawyers, that you start putting new felony conspiracy laws on the books and start prosecuting people, it's going to have an impact on my shot. And what I'm saying is that I think I'm taking a conservative approach. Two felony level lawyers, two support staff in terms of investigation and paralegal, and then the clerks and typists who process the paperwork. I know it's a long-winded answer, but am I getting at what you're asking?
Mr. Chairman, you're not really, because my concern was that in your giving us testimony on this bill, you testified more so on what the fiscal impact, and I appreciate that very much. I'm not finding fault with that at all. But your whole testimony appears to me to be the fiscal impact rather than the substance of the bill. Is this a good bill? Do we need this bill to fight crime in Alaska? Is this going to achieve some ends to cutting crime in Alaska? I didn't get that from you. This is going to be a very expensive bill to prosecute, so. Thanks, James. So, you know, that's where I was coming from, and that concerns me. And no problem.
Thanks. Well, I can't resist, John. A couple of comments and a question. I do believe that you and perhaps Brent were the only people who weren't saying that, as regards to the marijuana analogy, that law enforcement would not be filling up the jails the next day and costing a whole lot of money. I fought that battle for a long time, too. And quite frankly, I do have a philosophical difference with you in one regard, that if conspiracy would cause someone to run down the hall and rat on his buddy, I'm all for it. I do have a question on your fiscal note. Putting it in proportion, it represents a 5.3% increase in your overall total budget, $402,000 as opposed to $7.6 million. That's what, one in 20 cases of these 17,000 that you apparently annually have would be conspiracy? Is that what you really think the impact would be?
The number of cases?
Mm-hmm. That's about 800.
I think, Mr. Chairman, it's difficult to quantify what the impact of proposed criminal justice legislation will have. And I admit that it's somewhat speculative. The way we approach this is we understand, based on our analysis and our research, that conspiracy cases are burdensome to litigate from a defense perspective. Maybe they're easier from a prosecution. I mean, you can't always make comparisons. but it might be easier for prosecution because people are running down the hall and ratting on their buddy and people are cutting deals and stuff. But that doesn't always make it easier for us. And so what I'm saying is, it looks like the focus would be in urban areas, especially if you're going after drug rings and things like this. Probably not going to be out in Selawick or Ambler or Teller or places like that so much as in Fairbanks and Anchorage and maybe to a lesser extent in June. We felt that in order to absorb that, given our staffing levels, our current staffing levels, and again, I don't think you can make these decisions in a vacuum. You have to look at what you've got to work with already in your caseload. And you know, we're caseload driven. Everything the court gives us, we have to take. We can't say, sorry, we don't have time for this one. When I look at how we're overburdened in our larger metropolitan areas, and I look at what, where this conspiracy bill is going to have its hit, I say, I'm going to need at least one lawyer in each of those places. And they're going to need some help because of the nature of this litigation. Lots of police reports, lots of tapes to absorb, lots of transcripts to read, lots of indexing to do. And then the pretrial work, all the motions to suppress on Sixth Amendment, Fourth Amendment grounds. So I understand you being skeptical. And, you know, I wouldn't want to sort of have my reputation, my entire reputation as a public defender based on this fiscal note, because I could be wrong. I'm the first to admit that. But I'm not trying to inflate it. I'm just, two attorneys and support staff, to me, is a realistic assessment of the impact of the conspiracy bill based on how I think it would operate. And I know there's a difference of opinion as to how it would be used.
Are there any further questions? Okay, thank you very much, John.
All right.
Next, we can thank have Brent McGee from the Office of Public Advocacy. Welcome.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. As Deputy Chief Edelman pointed out, this is kind of an annual get-together of people who are in favor of and opposed to the conspiracy bill. I've always been opposed to the conspiracy bill for a couple of reasons. One, as a defense attorney of some experience, I don't think it's necessary. And I know that previous chief prosecutors in the state have challenged law enforcement agencies to come forward with a case in which they were unable to prosecute under the theory of accomplice liability for the crime of attempt or for the crime of solicitation, and that they have, over a period of years, and that they never received a sufficient response from law enforcement agencies to show that, in fact, it was necessary. In fact, Deputy Commissioner Swackhammer's example today was the first example in all the years that I've been listening to this debate in which a concrete example was raised regarding folks that he would be unable to prosecute who were involved in a conspiracy to distribute narcotics. And I think it is an interesting one because he points out that a number of these folks who were, in effect, on the periphery of a drug conspiracy, those who supply phony driver's licenses or perhaps arrange for transportation or of individuals or whatever, play some small role in advancing a particular conspiracy. But what I think that the bill does, and most conspiracy bills do exactly this, and that is that they allow for the conviction of individuals irrespective of the level of their involvement in the conspiracy. And face sanctions for the same crime, and I think that that's where I part company with proponents of the this bill or conspiracy laws in general. And that is that I think it's important to recognize that these are basically philosophical disagreements because you, as a former chief of the Anchorage Police Department, and I, as a defense attorney in Anchorage and a lifelong resident of Anchorage, haven't dealt with conspiracy laws before. I don't know what they look like. I don't know what they're like to defend. I don't know what they're like to prosecute. But I think there are some different philosophical approaches that we bring to this problem. The criminal justice system does two things. It's supposed to do two things. It's supposed to convict the guilty and protect the innocent. And I think that the passage of this law runs a significant risk of putting innocent people and peripherally involved people at risk of facing serious criminal sanctions. That is an opinion. Based upon what I have read about the application of conspiracy laws throughout the century. And it's an opinion that is also informed by the fact that, and although I don't think that it's likely under state law in Alaska, certainly, that conspiracy laws have been used very widely by federal authorities to suppress political dissent, starting in the very first decades of this century, right up through the 1970s. They are laws that are the handmaiden of abuse. They allow the charging of people who are peripherally involved with other folks who are engaged in criminal activity. As you suggest, I think there's a substantial probability that folks may come running down the hall anxious to talk to the assistant DA because of their potential exposure to this. That may be a positive benefit of passage of such a bill. I don't know. I do think there's some possibility of roping in some folks who probably ought not to be roped into the criminal justice process. The second reason that I'm opposed to this bill, and this is something that has mystified me, maybe because I've become more of a bureaucrat and less of a defense attorney over the years, and that is cost. Cost is something that my agency has to be concerned about with on a daily basis. We have experienced a 69% increase in our caseload since 1988 alone. Cases cost money. The feds have a conspiracy law that's been on the books for a very long time. They used it successfully in pursuit in Alaska in pursuit of drug conspiracies. We do have, I believe, still a program of cross deputization of prosecutors. We do refer, state authorities do refer drug cases to federal authorities for prosecution. And I can't, frankly, for the life of me, as a citizen of a state where we're facing declining oil revenues, understand why we would raise our hand and volunteer to take additional cases. Right now, we have the ability to refer to federal authorities, and they have the ability to pursue drug conspiracies, and perhaps on a cost level, even more important, they have the ability to incarcerate those who are convicted. We spend $36,000 a year on every person we convicted. We convict, so it doesn't take very many folks to be convicted in a particular year. Let's say 10 people for who receive 10 years, who receive 10-year sentences, and we're talking millions of dollars. I don't understand why we would volunteer to do that. I guess finally, I think that while I don't perceive that there is a strong need, and I don't think that a need has been demonstrated for passage of this legislation, I do think it will be used. I think it's like any other tool, particularly one that has been used in other jurisdictions. I think it will get used, and I think it will get used a lot. As Mr. Salemi pointed out, and I've had some experience in joint trials as well, the more lawyers you put in a room, you increase the time involved in the proceeding exponentially. And I know that there is probably some mathematical factor out there that we could all arrive at with some experience, but I can tell you the time devoted to a particular proceeding is going to extend dramatically. We're going to have lawyers tied up in conspiracy trials that are going to go on for weeks, if not months, given the volume of evidence that is ordinarily gathered in the course of such investigations. Every time that we have a lawyer down for that period, we can't assign cases to that attorney. We can't, the other proceedings in which that lawyer is involved have to be either transferred or more likely delayed. So when you make pass laws that include lengthy trial proceedings, you affect the operation of the criminal justice system and you impede the ability of that system to process the more typical cases that represent just as significant a threat to public safety. And I'm talking about robberies, burglaries, different types of homicide. So I think there's a real chance that this is going to, the passage of this law, the use of conspiracy as a means of prosecution, is going to mean that other things that we all would consider a priority are going to go by the board, or are going to be harmed. The fiscal note that I submitted includes a single individual staff member together with support, and together with contractual services, estimated at approximately $15,000 a case. I've used that $15,000 as an estimate every year for at least the past couple of years, and I'm almost to the point of laughing at it at this point. I think that that is a highly conservative effort estimate, and I think it would be interesting to know, it would have been interesting to ask Mr. Brennan, your private counsel, if a conspiracy defendant came into his office and offered him a $15,000 retainer, whether he would take the case. I think that most criminal defense attorneys would turn that case down. The canine unit is responding. I think it's a highly conservative effort. I would also echo the remarks of Mr. Salemi in saying that none of us really know what is going to happen if this legislation is passed. But the one thing that I'm quite confident of is that it will be used and it will cost money.
Thank you. Any questions? Mr. McGee, Representative Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one question concerning your fiscal note. Can you just amplify my own sake, I suppose, why the cost runs out the later years and becomes a little more expensive?
You know,
we're just looking at just cost of living allowances something else?
We're given every year a magic percentage figure that we apply to each of the figures in the columns, and we apply it and we stretch it out in that manner. That's why it goes, for example, the total goes from 513 to 517. It doesn't mean I think it's intended to reflect the real, assuming that you spend X amount of dollars in year one, you're going to have to spend X plus Y amount of dollars because of inflation or some other factor. But I don't know what the percentage is that we're using this year to do that. But it's something that we get from on high, and we apply it in all fiscal notes and stretch it out. It doesn't mean, it's not a reflection of increased resources being devoted to these cases. And that raises an interesting point, because it's going to cost us more in the second and third years of operation of such a statute, because we're going to have the appellate impact of these cases in the second and third and fourth years. But I can't, because I don't know the number of convictions that will be obtained, I don't know how much it's going to cost to do the appeal. I don't know the constitutional dimensions that I don't understand, I should frankly admit, the constitutional dimensions that will be, or issues that will be raised by passage of this legislation. So it's hard for me to estimate how many hours will be devoted to each appeal in these cases, and therefore it is not included in the fiscal note here, because I'm totally in the dark as to how to estimate the fiscal impact of the appellate process in such cases.
Thank you. I only raised the question because we are faced with a number of fiscal notes, mm-hmm. and I noticed that the Department of Corrections and Department of Alaska Court System does not use the same procedure.
Yeah.
Theirs is pretty constant. I'm just wondering if there's some magical formula that is used.
There is, and I wish I could explain to you why. I had assumed we were all using the same magic formula. Obviously, we're not, and I don't know why that is. I don't know.
Thank you. Representative Phillips?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. McGee, one of your comments that you made was that you don't see a need for this kind of legislation. But this issue has been before the legislative body for the last 6 or 7 years. People coming and saying, we need to have it. Mm-hmm. There is a need out there for this legislation. So I guess I don't necessarily have a question for you, just a statement.
Sure.
If there has been this feeling over the years that we need it, if the need wasn't there, the request to do this should have gone away in the ensuing years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I have asked, and I think that the former chief prosecutor for the Department of Law asked, where's the evidence? Show me the case where you needed this law and you could have nailed some more bad guys. She was not presented with that evidence. And in fact, Deputy Commissioner Swackhammer's testimony here today was the first time I've heard the evidence that in fact a conspiracy law would have enabled him to reach these other folks it was my inference from his remarks, and of course they were not in great detail, were more peripherally involved, and they were only able to make arrests of people who were directly involved in the drug transactions.
If I could continue, Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
And maybe we've reached that point in Alaska today with the drug trafficking and the impact of drugs in Alaska today that maybe that it has changed around the last few years. Maybe we are seeing a need now based, you know, not on other things, but definitely in the area of drug abuse and drug trafficking.
That could well be, and I would not be surprised to see the such laws applied to bootlegging as well. I just don't know if the person who makes the phone, you know, a phone call off out on the periphery should be equally criminally liable with the person who actually, you know, makes the profit and does the transaction. But that's a policy question, and that's what you folks were elected on.
Brad, just one observation, recognizing, as you said, and as Mr. Levy said, that you're obviously engaged in some speculation on the impact. But your impact is a full 7.8% increase in the budget.
The reason for that is that we do about 11,000 cases a year, and some cases are more expensive than other cases. And felony trials are the single most expensive cases that we do in general, with the possible exception of representing abused children and termination of parental rights cases. Those are the big cases, and we have, unfortunately, a heck of a lot more felony trials than we have termination trials. They're expensive.
Let me ask you just one short question now. Is it possible that, in recognizing that I believe you do, that this statute, this bill, only covers serious, the highest class A felony crimes against persons, no
right.
crimes against property,
exactly.
and serious narcotics offenses? Recognizing that, would it not be conceivable that at least some of these cases that would be brought under conspiracy for those kinds of crimes would actually prevent the commission, or the attempt, if you will, since we knew about it, of the cases, do some prevention work and actually not impact anyone too seriously, because we would have had the crime and hopefully the arrest and trial anyway.
You mean because, I can posit a situation where you may be able to make an arrest for conspiracy before you had the elements of an attempt and thereby prevent the crime. I think that that's possible. I mean, I think there aren't very many such cases. I think that that is a potential great result of a particular of a passage of the bill. I can imagine them, you know, because I get paid to imagine particular situations. But I don't think there'd be very many. But I can't deny that you'd have a concrete success there, and you would prevent, you know, the creation of more victims in that instance.
Okay. We'll open the meeting of the House Judiciary Committee. It's 1:15, February 17th. And present are Representative Green, Representative Cott, myself, Representative Porter, Representative Phillips, and joining us at the table, Representative Bundy. We have a quorum. Representative James is ill and has notified us that she's going to try to rest up so she can make the 6 o'clock session. And Representatives Nordlund and
Davidson.
Hopefully will join us as we go along. The first bill we have in front of us today is House Bill 43, crime, dealing with crime and conspiracy. As the sponsor of this bill, I will make a very brief statement and then ask or advise that we have several people desiring to testify, some here and some on teleconference, which we are on now, and that hopefully a good explanation of the crime of conspiracy and the need for the legislation will come out during that testimony rather than me having to make a big speech to you right now, so I will not do that. What I would like to do first is to go through the teleconference sites and pick up the testimony from those people, and then get to the testimony from the people here in the room. So at the top of my list, we were to receive testimony from Chief Richard Ross, who is Chief of Police of Kenai, also the chairman this year of the Police Standards Council. He had a conflict at the last minute, but did send a letter of support for the bill, which you have in front of you. Next, I would like to ask Ann Palmer if Chief Ron Ani of the Palmer Police Department, also this year's president of the Alaska Chiefs of Police Association, is ready to testify.
Yes, Brian, thank you. I can hear you here in Wasilla.
Aha. Hello, Wasilla. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Well, as you know, the Alaska law enforcement chiefs for many, many years have been requesting and supporting the different forms of conspiracy legislation that has been brought forward. And as we all know, there's never been any success in getting those enacted into law. I think Alaska probably right now is the only state in the entire 50, there may be one other, but I think Alaska is the only one that does not have a conspiracy law. There have been many reservations expressed over the years about the potential abuse by law enforcement wherein minor crimes, petty crimes, things like prostitution and other things in that category would be the target of conspiracy investigations. And I think House Bill 43 introduced by you, Brian, really does address some of those concerns. It limits conspiracy to serious felony offenses. I think that's a very sensible approach, and one certainly that law enforcement and the Chiefs Association supports. I've been in this business 27 years, and I'm not going to bore you with all of the crimes, serious crimes that I've seen committed, that there was some opportunity, or may have been some opportunity, prior to the commission of those crimes to intervene and make arrests. There certainly have been a number over the years. I know that Dwayne Utland, who I think is in Anchorage, his very first week in Anchorage, found himself as a deputy chief involved in a murder plot to kill a clerk at a business in Anchorage. And he was out all night with several of his officers working that case. I think they certainly could have intervened and interjected much earlier in that process had we had a conspiracy statute. It's one that we desperately need. It's not one that would ever be abused in this state. Certainly the way that it's written here, I think, provides those protections. I don't know that I can say any more than that, other than I really urge you to take this seriously and pass this for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Audie. Are there any questions? I see none. Okay, Chief, thank you very much. Is there anyone else in Wasilla that would wish to testify?
No, sir, there are not.
All right, thank you again. I'd like to now go to Sitka and ask if Virginia Phillips is online.
I'm here, and I feel like I need to tell you who I am. I'm Virginia Phillips, and I lived in West Virginia for many years. And in West Virginia, we have minimum security prison called the Kennedy Youth Center, and I did volunteer work there as a life school worker, and that was my first introduction to how conspiracy works and a few other things, just working with these young men. There's young women there now, too. And then later, I went to Gonzaga University and got my undergraduate degree in criminal justice, and that's when I found out, this was in the early 80s, that Alaska did not have a conspiracy statute. And that, I was shocked. But while I was at Gonzaga getting my undergraduate degree, I took some extra courses in understanding the criminal mind. And my reason for doing that was because when I worked at the Kennedy Youth Center, I realized our prison systems aren't working. A lot of things weren't working, and I've been trying to figure out solutions. Needless to say, I really believe we need conspiracy to be defined and punished as a crime, because it's often necessary for more than one person to be involved in order to commit the crime. Sometimes it's just the act of brainstorming the best ways to commit a crime that gives the person, if it's just one person committing the crime, the courage to commit the crime. And I would urge people to vote for this statute. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Virginia, for your testimony. Are there any questions? Seeing none, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd now like to go to Seward and ask if Vicki Siegel is online.
She stepped out of the office, but I'm here.
Okay, in Seward we have Chief Tom Walker of the Seward Police Department. Chief, please go ahead.
I'd like to voice my support for House Bill 43, the conspiracy law. Passage of House Bill 43 would bring Alaska in line with the rest of the country regarding the crime of conspiracy. I believe Alaska is the only state that doesn't currently have a conspiracy law on the books, but also provide a vehicle by which the law enforcement and prosecutors could apprehend and convict violators that would normally never be charged unless convicted. It's difficult to prosecute, more difficult to convict a person as a principal in a crime that they are not a smoking gun participant. This is particularly common in murder for hire cases. A pillar of the community can pay for the murder of another person, yet juries find it difficult or even impossible to find him guilty of the murder or the attempt. Juries tend to require a defendant to be at the scene of the crime, preferably have the gun in their hand, to convict for murder or attempted murder. House Bill 43 should make it easier for them to understand the role of a conspirator and change that attitude. Another area in which a conspiracy law would be very helpful is in drug enforcement. Under current law, it's necessary to make a hand-to-hand purchase of a controlled substance to charge anyone for sale of that controlled substance. The organizers, the investors, and the money launderers effectively immune to prosecution. If a conspiracy law would exclude the necessity of a buy to prosecute, cases could be built on testimony of co-conspirators, subordinates, and other witnesses. Physical evidence such as financial records, wired conversations, etc., would go much further to convict for conspiracy than possession and sale charges. We're beginning to see more organized crime in Alaska. This, in some cases, goes back to routine drug investigations, protection rackets, gambling, prostitution, etc. It could also include the new ethnic-based gang activities that have surfaced in Anchorage. These gangs are centered around and financed by the sale of crack cocaine and the protection of turf. I can see where the larger cities using the conspiracy law to effectively combat such an influx of drug-related crimes up to and including murder.
Thank you, Chief. Are there any questions of Chief Walker? Representative Phillips has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Chief Walker, if you would, just on your last statement, please, if you would give us some examples and reiterate for my clarification why you feel, the last sentence, that this would tend to break down the advancement we're seeing, especially in the gangs in Anchorage. If you could just hit on that a little bit more, please.
Gangs are a very tightly knit group and organization, and they tend to use the drive-by shootings and the crack cocaine almost without any charges at all being brought against them. With the conspiracy law, they wouldn't have to go isolated crime by isolated crime. They could go after the heads of the organization based on the conspiring to commit any and all of these crimes as opposed to each individual crime.
Thank you very much.
Is there anything further? Okay, Chief, thank you very much. Is there anyone else there that wishes to testify?
Negative.
All right, Tom, thank you. I'd like to go now to Barrow. We have two people in Barrow. The first one on the list with the North Slope Public Safety Department is Greg Venable. Are you there, Greg?
Good afternoon. From Barrow, Alaska. My name is Sergeant Greg Venable. I work narcotics up here. I've seen a real void in the prosecution of narcotics. We work real closely with a lot of the agencies throughout the state and identified drug traffickers moving from Barrow to different parts of the state and vice versa. We've found a real void trying to prosecute a lot of these cases, drug cases, because of not having a conspiracy statute to deal with. I would be 100% in support of Bill number 43, and I think it would be a great help in the suppression of drug trafficking in the state. And I also concur with the other testimony that I've heard in relationship to the other crimes, such as murder and gang activity. I'd be in support of this bill 100%.
Thank you, Sergeant. I had indication that you would also like to make a comment on House Bill 100 dealing with the prosecution of juvenile felons.
Yes, I'd also like to reiterate that I would be in favor of that bill also. 100% supportive.
Thank you very much. Next we have in Barrow, James Lamoureux.
Yes, Chairman Porter and other members of the committee. My name is Jim Lamoureux. I'm a sergeant in charge of the village unit for the North Slope Borough Department of Public Safety. My address is P.O. Box 470, for the record. I have been a police officer for approximately 20 years, the last 12 years with the North Slope Borough Department of Public Safety. I'm currently in charge of the department's village unit. We cover the seven outlying communities across the North Slope and Prudhoe Bay, with a total area of approximately 91,000 square miles. During my stay and on the North Slope, working with the various communities, community members, and the officers assigned to those villages, I've seen numerous occasions when drug traffickers in particular have used the members of these communities to not only sell their drugs, but also launder their money, and leaving us with little or no leverage to directly prosecute the people who are actually causing a great deal of this disruption of village life in Bush, Alaska. I would also like to just to add something else that I forgot here at the beginning. Chief Christensen could not be here. He sends his regrets, but requests that we not only voice our opinion, but also let you know that he's 100% in favor of this bill, as I believe all officers on our department are. My only other comment on the bill is that it seems to be a very thorough bill, and echoing those comments by earlier speakers, that it leaves out a lot of the lesser crimes, I think it gives you a good feeling for the authorship of the bill. It was meant to take care of some key crimes that are most common in Alaska, and I believe it would be a very effective piece of legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Sergeant. Did you have a comment on House Bill 100?
Only that, once again, we feel it's an appropriate bill, and that even in our outlying posts, we could effectively handle the implementation of that law. Our only real concern is that there be funding made available to the appropriate agencies so that they can take up the slack in the area where in the past we have stepped in when dealing with youthful offenders.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Okay, seeing none, I would like to go to Anchorage. I have a list of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 people, but only indication that one wishes to testify on House Bill 43. I'll ask that Ray Brown testify now, and then I'll ask afterwards if anyone else there wishes to make any comments on House Bill 43. So, Ray, if you're present, can we have your testimony, please?
Can you hear me, Chairman Porter?
Sure can.
Okay, good. Just for the record, although I hesitate to say this, there are two other individuals that want to testify. I think Linda Branchflower, Officer Branchflower from the Anchorage Police Department, and Deputy Chief Unlin.
Thank you.
They are present. With that in mind, I'd like to, first of all, start out and thank the committee for allowing us to make or to offer this telephonic testimony. And to start out my comments, so that I'm going to talk briefly about policy and briefly about physical, and probably more in some detail about the physical implications of this bill. But I think it will be real clear. I'm a representative from the Alaska Academy of Trial Lawyers, and my position certainly differs significantly from the testimony previously offered by the respective chiefs of police, both in Palmer and in Seward, and to some extent the officers who testified from Barrow. And I'd like to comment, first of all, about Chief Audie's concern about the interventional aspects of and the advantages of the conspiracy bill. The case which Chief Audie talked about, I believe, was State versus Martin Elsey. It was a case which I was very familiar with because I represented Mr. Elsey at one stage of the proceedings, and that was a case that theoretically could have been charged as a conspiracy to murder. Instead, he was convicted ultimately. I wasn't the trial attorney, of attempted murder. But I would point out that in that case, the state had an extraordinarily difficult time of convicting him of attempted murder after he entered the hotel. Had he been charged as a conspirator and the intervention had been sought previously, there would have been absolutely no chance whatsoever of convicting Mr. Elsey of the crime. And I suggest to this committee that if this bill is being used as an interventional device, it will fall and fail flatly on its face. Indeed, most of the times or most of the applications of a conspiracy bill deal with after-the-fact criminal activity. And for that reason, I'll talk about it in a minute, most of them deal with completed drug conspiracies and not on an attempt by law enforcement agencies or prosecutors to intervene in any way to stop a crime. Also, with the chief, I believe, from Seward's comments that it would tend to break down gangs, I would point out that California, probably, and New York State, two of the states that have the most significant gang problems in the United States, have had for several years conspiracy statutes. And I would also point out that it has done nothing whatsoever to curtail or in any way influence gang activity or to significantly increase, or may have significantly increased prosecution, but it does nothing to do, has nothing to do with curtailing gang activity. The bill of conspiracy, with all due respect, Chairman Porter, I know it's your bill, and I think that the intentions are good, and I'm not disputing that, but there has never been a bill passed in the history of Congress that has resulted in more prosecutorial abuse than the conspiracy bill. As you are no doubt aware, the conspiracy bill developed into the Racketeering and Influence Corrupt Act, RICO. It has been used and abused thousands of times in the federal system. It has spawned more litigation than any single bill. In short, I guess it mirrors my concerns about the author Thomas Wolfe in his book Bonfire of the Vanities, that a liberal is a conservative who's been indicted, and so many times the bill of the conspiracy bill has been used and misused to indict otherwise innocent persons just because they were at the wrong place at the wrong time or associated, unfortunately, with the wrong individuals. The conspiracy bill is bad policy. But I know that the policy considerations will not cause the legislature to pass or to vote down this particular bill, or I'm sure that the policy considerations will not dictate whether or not it gets out of committee. I think that that you are going to look very strongly at the fiscal implications, at least I hope you do, because I think that you, as a committee and as a governing body, has a responsibility to be truthful, and I'm sure you are, and honest, and I know you are, your reputation and the committee, with the constituents. And this bill, from fiscal policy reasons, is bad. First, there already exist significant statutes on the book which cover this, and that was conceded, incidentally, by the Attorney General, Mr. Cole, who basically said that there's already on the books significant statutory law which allows the prosecution for attempt or for attempted for crimes involving an attempt and for crimes involving accomplice liability. Those statutes suffice. Regarding the whether or not they enable more or additional information or evidence to come before a jury, it's just not true. Under evidentiary rule, Alaska Rule of Evidence 801C2E, this evidence, if there is a conspiracy or if there are multiple defendants involved, this same type of evidence is introduced on a routine basis if any statements were made during and in the furtherance of a conspiracy. So it will not, it doesn't give the prosecution What it will do, and history has bared this out in the federal system, it will spawn multiple defendant trials. And I'm not talking about two or three defendants who will be brought together and joined as co-defendants. It will spawn 7, 8, 9, 11, 15 defendant trials. It will be expedient. The state will make that argument, that it will be cost-effective. There will be antagonistic defenses raised, and the antagonistic defenses will cause, and under current interpretation, at least at the federal level, of grounds for severance for prejudicial joinder, that is not necessarily a ground for severance. What you're going to have, particularly in multiple defendant and conspiracy cases, is cases that would last a few days are going to last a few weeks. Courtrooms throughout the state are not set up for this. There's going to have to be a revamping of several courtrooms. When you have multiple defendant trials, you're going to have multiple attorneys. And I've read Mr. Salemi and Mr. McGee's fiscal note that was attached, that was supplied to the committee, and it's correct, although I think it's somewhat understated. There's going to be a tremendous burden on the Office of Public Advocacy to hire additional attorneys, to find attorneys that are going to represent multiple defendant cases. In the Bush, it's going to be particularly problematic, and the officer from Barrow stated that it would help to have this conspiracy statute. The federal government already prosecutes federal conspiracies in the Bush, but let's assume the state wants to take on that incredible burden. I want to pose to you the problems that would be inherent in a 5-to-8 defendant case in Barrow. The public defenders would get the first case. The remainder would be conflicted to the Fairbanks Office of Public Advocacy. The Fairbanks Office of Public Advocacy would take one case if they didn't have an existing conflict, and they would take the other if it was a 6-defendant case, 4, and have to hire attorneys in Fairbanks to represent the remaining 4 defendants. The same story would echo throughout the state. The cost of flying attorneys, housing them, and providing them meals and expenses. Moreover, hiring investigators, because each defendant would be entitled to have his case to be under the Sixth Amendment to have a fair and adequate defense, which would entail having an investigator independently investigate that particular defendant's case, particularly when there were and there will be antagonistic defenses. I would point to this committee a recent case that was indicted in Anchorage by the federal government. There were 11 defendants, and I would point to this committee that this is the exact type of case that would be frequently used by the state system. These were crack house defendants. This was a conspiracy alleging the dealing by various people running crack houses, obtaining false identification, renting apartments, aliases, and so forth. Each one of those attorneys that was, first of all, the federal public defender took one of those. The other 10 had to be apportioned out. Judge Holland finally had to issue an order that people could not refuse to take these cases if they were on the panel of appointed counsel. The reason is, because there's not that many criminal defense attorneys that are willing to get involved in a multi-defendant conspiracy litigation, particularly when the Office of Public Advocacy is paying $50 an hour. At the federal level, it's $75 an hour. So let's assume that you can get the attorneys. I think Anchorage is the only city where that would be possible. Otherwise, if you can't get the attorneys, you're going to have to bring them in from other cities, other places where the attorneys are willing to accept and take the representation. And I suggest to you that it's very difficult to impossible to find 10 or 11 criminal defense lawyers. And I know there's no shortage of lawyers, but there is a big shortage of lawyers that are willing to work at $50 an hour. The problem is compounded when you take this out into the Bush, and I've already addressed that earlier. Assuming that the fiscal note is correct from the Department of Corrections, think about and let your constituents know what this is going to be to the increased burden on our already overcrowded prison system and given the existing presumptive sentencing laws. It's going to be overwhelming. In conclusion, I urge the committee to consider, first of all, the policy reasons. It is bad policy. But second, and I think the decision or the most important factor that this committee is going to consider are the realistic fiscal application or implications of this bill. They are potentially staggering. They will result in a significantly increased cost. The prosecutor will use them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Are there questions? And I see indicated by Representative Phillips. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Comment first, and then I do have a question. If Alaska is the only state that doesn't have conspiracy laws to date, it seems like to me that this necessarily couldn't be such bad policy if all the other states, I'm not meaning to argue with you, but if all the other states have adopted conspiracy legislation, we are the only ones that haven't. I think that speaks a pretty good argument for itself right there. You made a statement that more prosecutorial abuse has been determined because of this law than any other. In our bill, where this bill calls for seriously only of serious felony offenses. Won't that mitigate some of the concern you have as far as abuse on this?
Well, it would certainly mitigate against persons conspiring to commit a misdemeanor and then being convicted of a felony of conspiracy, but it will not mitigate against the abuses by the prosecution to have multiple defendant trials. That's the problem. And, I mean, there's a lot of problems with this bill, but that is one of the problems. Certainly, it will be better than some of the existing states, and I believe Oregon is one, in which a person can conspire to commit a misdemeanor and be convicted of a felony for conspiring, for being the conspirator, period. And it's certainly better than the federal statute. But that doesn't mean that it's good policy. And if I could address your comment about the other 49 states having conspiracy laws on the books, I don't know whether or not that is accurate or not. I know that a significant majority of the states, in fact, do have conspiracy laws. But Alaska has a very strong attempt statute and a very strong accomplice liability statute, which embraces all of the concerns that are being articulated here by the representative parties. Alaska is unique in many ways. We have a right to privacy that no other state has enacted, constitutionally or otherwise. We have case law that is much more restricted to protect the rights of others, that is unique to Alaska and unlike the other 49 states. We have an application, and there was also a question I had with C2A C of this bill, portion of the bill, regarding its strict liability application. That is that it negates, apparently, a mens rea for the first one of the conspirators involved in the crime. Alaska, among all states, under a case called Guest versus State, does not apply strict liability to the same degree that the other 49 states do. We've been a minority jurisdiction in many ways. With an example that comes to mind readily is our availability of a mistake of a fact defense, reasonable mistake of fact defense, on statutory rape. California and Alaska were the only two states in the union that adopted those provisions, even though all legal scholars and legal commentators, virtually every law review article in the nation, has embraced guest analysis and our Supreme Court's analysis and application of a restriction of strict liability application, we are in the distinct minority. Indeed, now, after Hernandez has been substantially emasculated in California, we're the only state that significantly restricts strict liability application of crime. So I don't think that it's good policy, and I don't think unless you really understand or study the history of the bills in each particular state and what abuses have occurred, I don't think it's necessarily appropriate to say, geez, we're the only state that doesn't have this particular statute, because I think you need to look and see what the remainder of those state statutory framework are, number one, and number two, study, and I'm sure you will find tremendous abuses in the court system. I mean, if California is going to be used as an example, I can't think of a bigger mess of a state. Look at their court system. Look at they're bankrupt. And that's exactly what these bills will tend to do. Not, lawyers are already unpopular. Criminal defense lawyers probably more so than others. But as a group, attorneys, I mean, theoretically think about this. Attorneys stand to benefit from this, except to the extent they will be hired or privately retained. It's the public that will suffer from the fiscal application of this bill. They'll suffer tremendously. But more importantly, it will be the fringe person that wouldn't have been charged because of their role in this purported conspiracy was so de minimis, or it will be the person that's charged for leverage to get plea agreements or to ask this person or force this person to testify under some type of grant of limited, well, transactional immunity is required, but it will be those types of people who will suffer greatly over this. And I think that you just can't dismiss the fiscal and the policy applications by looking at the other jurisdictions where this has been applied.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Brown. I have a quick question, please. You have indicated, and I think correctly, that in this state, the current criminal statutes that embrace accomplice responsibility and criminal attempts narrow the gap, if you will, of where a conspiracy statute would enter. With that in mind, why do you still think that there would be a significant fiscal impact from this statute?
Because Chairman Porter, the whole purpose behind this bill and the whole thrust and the whole, you and I know it, I think, better than most because of our involvement in the criminal justice system. What this is going to do is spawn multiple defendant indictments in cases that ordinarily could not be joined for prosecution. What that means, clear and simple, it's going to greatly impact the prosecutorial decision to indict in drug cases. Many times, the accomplice liability and amended statutes are not applied to drug cases, although they do tend to be at times. This bill is going to be primarily directed at drug conspiracies, and that's the problem that I have. And it's going to spawn multiple defendant trials, unlike anything that we have seen in this state before. And you don't have to take my word for it. Go across the street here in Anchorage to the federal courthouse, where you see sometimes six and seven defendants sitting behind tables, or at the very least four and five. Well, you don't see that under the statutes. They indict individually under the accomplice or under the attempt statute. But in this case, given the ease of which it will be to demonstrate, at least before a grand jury, the existence of a conspiracy and a person's participation, we're going to see huge multiple defendant trials. And that's something that, like I said, you don't have to take my word for it. Look at the federal system. Go to California. Go to Washington State. Go to Oregon. See what kind of morass occurs as a result of these types of indictments. And that's the problem that I see.
All right. Thank you very much. Are there any other questions? Okay, if not, thank you very much, Mr. Brown. Next, in Anchorage, if we could have Deputy Chief Dwayne Udlin.
Yes, thank you for the opportunity to testify. I would like to say, Representative Porter, I do want to comment briefly about House Bill 100, so before I get off the hot seat, if you wouldn't mind.
Certainly.
This is probably about the sixth or seventh time that I can think of that I've testified on the conspiracy bill over the years. I think Mr. Brown's done a pretty good job of summarizing the concerns that primarily defense attorneys have raised. And I'm not going to argue that those concerns, that there isn't some well-founded belief in that, and that there's a reason to say the things that he said. They're certainly been echoed by many other very capable attorneys whose opinions I respect. But I'd like to point out a couple things. One, on the fiscal notes, I'm a little bit suspicious of them only in the sense that I think they're a worst-case scenario. Obviously, if you're going to come out against something, you're going to think in terms of how bad could it be, and I think that the high numbers that are reflected by OPA and the Public Defenders Agency probably reflect their belief of some even potential abuse. So I'm not so sure that would occur. And the other thing I'd like to say about the bill is that I don't see this as a magic bullet bill. And I don't see all of a sudden that we're going to have mass charging of everybody in the conspiracy. And, you know, the arguments against it sort of remind me of the arguments against the marijuana law that finally was put into a vote of the people. But I testified on that bill several times and sat in rooms where I heard debates and continuous horror stories about how law enforcement would be kicking down doors and arresting people in mass, and there'd be massive trials, and prisons would fill up, and on and on and on and on. And now we've had that law on the books now for almost 2 years, and it's been like a drop in the bucket. There's been simply no abuse of the marijuana law since passed. The prisons haven't filled up. And I think that the analogy is a correct analogy here. I just don't see those kinds of abuses taking place. I'm not going to argue that there haven't been abuses of conspiracy laws in other states. There probably has. But I can say that I think Alaska is a little bit different in that. I think that Alaska has a much higher standard for its law enforcement and for its people who work in the prosecution world. And I don't think if this bill was to pass, I don't think the legislature would have any problem at all repealing a law if there was abuses. This is a small state in terms of cases and numbers of people. And the word gets around pretty quick. The other thing is I think that I just think that this law is only going to apply to your more serious cases. I certainly don't. I've never heard anybody in law enforcement, from prosecution to police chiefs to individual officers who really understand conspiracy try to make a case that it's that they're going to be charging lots more people. But there are cases that are very appropriate for people to be charged under conspiracy laws. Now, maybe it's easy to charge people under conspiracy when you don't have something
Thank you, Chief Edlund. I'll not forget your desire to comment on House Bill 100, but before we get that, I'll ask if there's any questions on your testimony on House Bill 43. We have one from Representative Phillips.
Thank you, Chief Edlund. When you reviewed the bill, did you see anything in it that we needed to do to strengthen it, or are you comfortable with the bill in its final form right now?
Well, I'm comfortable in its present form, although I certainly am a layman and I don't have the expertise that, say, Mr. Brown might have, or perhaps I would imagine Dean Winnelli's there to answer some more difficult questions on the legal sense. But as a layman and as I understand conspiracy, I think this is a good bill.
Thank you.
Chief, how about House Bill 100?
House Bill 100 was something that I'm glad to see was introduced. Yeah, it's very similar to, I understand, the same as House Bill 101 last year that was introduced. And there's also a number of other bills in the legislature that are looking at the juvenile justice system. I would like to say that I think it's timely that the juvenile justice system be reexamined in the state of Alaska. That's what many other states have done. And the reason they have is because nature of juvenile crime has changed over the years. And, we've got a system that has its roots back in the 20s and 30s, and I think it's time to sort of update that. With respect to House Bill 100 specifically, I don't think it goes far enough, and I urge the committee to look at some of the features that are contained in Senate Bill 54, which primarily has some automatic waiver on most heinous offenses. And I think that be appropriate to really kind of get into the debate of House Bill 100 in light of Senate Bill 54. While I applaud the effort on House Bill 100, I think some timing would be very good to look at going a little further.
Thank you, Dwayne. Are there any questions on that regard? If not, Dwayne, thank you very much. Next in Anchorage, if Linda Branchflower, representing the Anchorage, or sorry, Alaska Peace Officers Association. I can hear you fine, Linda.
Okay. In reference to House Bill 43, I'd like to respond to something that Mr. Ray said. He sort of gave you a red herring when he was talking about the prosecutorial abuse that could possibly occur if this bill is passed. I think that we can't forget that there's also the Fourth Amendment that would allow suppression of evidence that was gained due to unreasonable search and seizure. And it is also the function of the grand jury to weed out cases that are unfit for prosecution. I don't think that if this bill is passed, that we're going to see prosecutors' offices going hog wild and seeing people in jail by the hundreds. That's all I have in reference to House Bill 43. I'd like to echo what Chief Edlund said, his sentiments also on that bill.
Thank you, Linda. Are there any questions? If not, did you wish to comment on House Bill 100?
I also wanted to echo what Chief Edlund had to say about House Bill 100. I'd like to see the wording from Senate Bill 54 be replaced, to replace House Bill 100. I think that House Bill 100 is